that. A fundamental rebuilding of the whole metaverse, carried out on a planet-wide corporate level. In the meantime, there may be a role for individuals who know their way around the place. A few hacks can make a lot of difference in this situation. A freelance hacker could get a lot of shit done, years before the giant software factories bestir themselves to deal with the problem. The virus that ate through David's brain was a string of binary information shown into his face in the form of a bitmap. A series of white and black pixels, where white represents zero and black represents one. They put the bitmap onto scrolls and gave the scrolls to avatars who went around the metaverse looking for victims. The Clint who tried to infect Hero in the Black Sun got away, but he left his scroll behind. He didn't reckon on having his arms lopped off, and Hero dumped it into the tunnel system below the floor, the place where the graveyard demons live. Later, Hero had a demon take the scroll back to his workshop. And anything that is in Hero's house is, by definition, stored inside his own computer. He doesn't have to jack into the global network in order to access it. It's not easy working with a piece of data that can kill you, but that's okay. In reality, people work with dangerous substances all the time, radioactive isotopes and toxic chemicals. You just have to have the right tools. Remote manipulator arms, gloves, goggles, leaded glass. And in Flatland, when you need a tool, you just sit down and write it. So Hero starts by writing a few simple programs that enable him to manipulate the contents of the scroll without ever seeing it. The scroll, like any other visible thing in the metaverse, is a piece of software. It contains some code that describes what it looks like, so that your computer will know how to draw it, and some routines that govern the way it rolls and unrolls. And it contains somewhere inside of itself a resource, a hunk of data, the digital version of the snow crash virus. Once the virus has been extracted and isolated, it is easy enough for Hero to write a new program called Snow Scan. Snow Scan is a piece of medicine. That is, it is code that protects Hero's system, both his hardware and, as Lagos would put it, his bioware, from the digital snow crash virus. Once Hero has installed it in his system, it will constantly scan the information coming in from outside, looking for data that matches the contents of the scroll. If it notices such information, it will block it. There's other work to do in Flatland. Hero's good with avatars, so he writes himself an invisible avatar, just because, in the new and more dangerous metaverse, it might come in handy. This is easy to do poorly and surprisingly tricky to do well. Almost anyone can write an avatar that doesn't look like anything, but it will lead to a lot of problems when it is used. Some metaverse real estate, including the Black Sun, wants to know how big your avatar is so that it can figure out whether you are colliding with another avatar or some obstacle. If you give it an answer of zero, you make your avatar infinitely small. You will either crash that piece of real estate or else make it think that something is very wrong. You will be invisible, but everywhere you go in the metaverse, you will leave a swath of destruction and confusion a mile wide. In other places, invisible avatars are illegal. If your avatar is transparent and reflects no light whatsoever, the easiest kind to write, it will be recognized instantly as an illegal avatar and alarms will go off. It has to be written in such a way that other people can't see it, but the real estate software doesn't realize that it's invisible. There are about 100 little tricks like this that Hero wouldn't know about if he hadn't been programming avatars for people like Vitaly Chernobyl for the last couple of years. To write a really good invisible avatar from scratch would take a long time, but he puts one together in several hours by recycling bits and pieces of old projects left behind in his computer, which is how hackers usually do it. While he's doing that, he comes across a rather old folder with some transportation software in it. This is left over from the very old days of the metaverse, before the monorail existed, when the only way to get around was to walk or to ride a piece of ware that simulated a vehicle. In the early days, when the metaverse was a featureless black ball, this was a trivial job. Later on, when the street went up and people started building real estate, it became more complicated. On the street, you can pass through other people's avatars, but you can't pass through walls, you can't enter private property, and you can't pass through other vehicles or through permanent street fixtures, such as the ports and the stanchions that support the monorail line. If you try to collide with any of these things, you don't die or get kicked out of the metaverse. You just come to a complete stop, like a cartoon character running spang into a concrete wall. In other words, once the metaverse began to fill up with obstacles that you can run into, the job of traveling across it at high speed suddenly became more interesting. Maneuverability became an issue. Size became an issue. Hero and David and the rest of them began to switch away from the enormous bizarre vehicles they had favored at first. Victorian houses on tank treads, rolling ocean liners, mile-wide crystalline spheres, flaming chariots drawn by dragons, in favor of small maneuverable vehicles. Motorcycles, basically. A metaverse vehicle can be as fast and nimble as a quark. There's no physics to worry about, no constraints on acceleration, no air resistance. Tires never squeal and brakes never lock up. The one thing that can't be helped is the reaction time of the user. So when they were racing their latest motorcycle software, holding wild rallies through downtown at Mach 1, they didn't worry about engine capacity. They worried about the user interface, the controls that enabled the rider to transfer his reactions into the machine, to steer, accelerate, or brake as quickly as he could think. Because when you're in a pack of bike racers going through a crowded area at that speed, and you run into something and suddenly slow down to a speed of exactly zero, you can forget about catching up. One mistake, and you've lost. Hero had a pretty good motorcycle. He probably could have had the best one on the street simply because his reflexes are unearthly. But he was more preoccupied with sword fighting than motorcycle riding. He opens up the most recent version of his motorcycle software, gets familiar with the controls again. He ascends from Flatland into the three-dimensional metaverse and practices riding his bike around his yard for a while. Beyond the boundaries of his yard is nothing but blackness, because he's not jacked into the net. It is a lost, desolate sensation, kind of like floating on a life raft in the Pacific Ocean. Sometimes they see boats in the distance. A couple of these even swing close by to check them out, but none of them seems to be in that rescuing mood. There are a few altruists in the vicinity of the raft, and it must be evident that they don't have much to steal. From time to time, they see an old deep-water fishing boat, 50 to 100 feet long, with half a dozen or so small, fast boats clustered around it. When Elliot informs them that these are pirate vessels, Vic and Fisheye prick up their ears. Vic unwraps his rifle from the collection of hefty bags that he uses to protect it from the salt spray, and detaches the bulky sight so that he can use it as a spyglass. Hero can't see any reason to pull the sight off the rifle in order to do this, other than the fact that if you don't, it looks like you're drawing a bead on whatever you're looking at. Whenever a pirate vessel comes into view, they all take turns looking at it through the sight, playing with all the different sensor modes, visible, infrared, and so on. Elliot has spent enough time knocking around the rim that he has become familiar with the colors of the different pirate groups. So by examining them through the sight, he can tell who they are. Clint Eastwood and his band parallel them for a few minutes one day, checking them out. And the Magnificent Seven send out one of their small boats to zoom by them and look for potential booty. Hero's almost hoping they get taken prisoner by the Seven, because they have the nicest-looking pirate ship. a former luxury yacht with Exocet launch tubes clutched to the foredeck. But this reconnaissance leads nowhere. The pirates, unschooled in thermodynamics, do not grasp the implications of the eternal plume of steam coming from beneath the life raft. One morning, a big old trawler materializes very close to them, congealing out of nothing as the fog lifts. Hiro has been hearing its engines for a while, but didn't realize how close it was.
"Who are they?"
Fisheye says, choking on a cup of the freeze-dried coffee he despises so much. He's wrapped up in a space blanket and partly snuggled underneath the boat's waterproof canopy, just his face and hands visible. Elliot scopes them out with the sight. He is not a real demonstrative guy, but it's clear that he is not very happy with what he sees.
"That is Bruce Lee," he says. "How is that significant?" Fisheye says.
"Well, check out the colors," Elliot says.
The ship is close enough that everyone can see the flag pretty clearly. It's a red banner with a silver fist in the middle, a pair of nunchucks crossed beneath it, the initials B and L on either side.
"What about them?" Fisheye says.
"Well, the guy who calls himself Bruce Lee, who's like the leader, he got a vest with those colors on the back."
"So?"
"So? It's not just embroidered or painted. It's actually done in scalps. Patchwork-like."
"Say what?" Hiro says.
"There's a rumor, just a rumor, man, that he went through the refuse ships looking for people with red or silver hair so he can collect the scalps he needed."
Hiro is still absorbing that when Fisheye makes an unexpected decision.
"I want to talk to this Bruce Lee character," he says. "He interests me."
"Why the hell do you want to talk to this fucking psycho?" Elliot says.
"Yeah," Hiro says. "Didn't you see that series in I Spy? He's a maniac."
Fisheye throws up his hands as if to say that the answer is, like Catholic theology, beyond mortal comprehension.
"This is my decision," he says.
"Who the fuck are you?" Elliot says.
"President of the fucking boat," Fisheye says. "I hereby nominate myself. Is there a second?"
"Yep,"
Vic says, the first time he has spoken in 48 hours.
"All in favor say aye," Fisheye says.
"Aye,"
Vic says, bursting into florid eloquence.
"I win," Fisheye says. "So how do we get these Bruce Lee guys to come over here and talk to us?"
"Why should they want to?" Elliot says. "We got nothing they want except for poontang."
"Are you saying these guys are homos?"
Fisheye says, his face shriveling up.
"Shit, man," Elliot says. "You didn't even blink when I told you about the scalps."
"I knew I didn't like any of this boat shit," Fisheye says.
"If this makes any difference to you, they're not gay in the sense that we usually think of," Elliot explains. "They're het, but they're pots. They'll go after anything that's warm and concave."
Fisheye makes a snap decision.
"Okay, you two guys, Hiro and Elliot, you're Chinese. Take off your clothes."
"What?"
"Do it. I'm president, remember? You want Vic to do it for you?"
Elliot and Hiro can't help looking over at Vic, who is just sitting there like a lump. There is something about his extremely blasé attitude that inspires fear.
"Do it, or I'll fucking kill you," Fisheye says,
finally driving the point home. Elliot and Hiro, bobbing awkwardly on the unsteady floor of the raft, peel off their survival suits and step out of them. Then they pull off the rest of their clothes, exposing smooth bare skin to the air for the first time in a few days. The trawler comes right alongside of them, no more than 20 away, and cuts its engines. They are nicely equipped, half a dozen Zodiacs with new outboards, an Exocet-type missile, two radars, and a 50-caliber machine gun at each end of the boat, currently unmanned. A couple of speedboats are being towed behind the trawler like dinghies, and each of these also has a heavy machine gun. And there is also a 36-foot motor yacht following them under its own power. There are a couple of dozen guys in Bruce Lee's pirate band, and they are now lined up along the trawler's railing, grinning, whistling, howling like wolves, and waving unrolled Trojans in the air.
"Don't worry, man. I'm not gonna let him fuck you," Fisheye says, grinning.
"What you gonna do?" Elliot says. Hand them a papal encyclical?
I'm sure they'll listen to reason, Fisheye says.
These guys aren't scared of the mafia, if that's what you have in mind,
Elliot says. That's just because they don't know us very well.
Finally, the leader comes out. Bruce Lee himself. A 40-ish guy in a Kevlar vest. An ammo vest stretched over that. A diagonal bandolier, samurai sword. Hero would love to take him on. Nunchucks and his colors. The patchwork of human skips. He flashes them a nice grin. Has a look at Hero and Elliot. Gives highly suggestive thrusting thumbs-up gesture. And then struts up and down the length of the boat one time, swapping high fives with his merry men. Every so often, he picks out one of the pirates at random and gestures the man's Trojan. The pirate puts his condom to his lips and inflates to a slippery ribbed balloon. Then Bruce Lee inspects it, making sure there are no leaks. Obviously, the man runs a tight ship. Hero can't help staring at the scalps on Bruce Lee's back. The pirates note his interest and mug for him, pointing to the scalps, nodding, looking back at him with wide, mocking eyes. The colors look much too uniform. No change in the red from one to the next. Hero concludes that Bruce Lee, contrary to his reputation, must have just gone out and gotten scalp any old color, bleached them, and dyed them. What a wimp. Finally, Bruce Lee works his way back to Midge and flashes them another big grin. He has a great, dazzling grin, and he knows it. Maybe it's those one-carat diamonds, crazy glued to his front teeth.
Jamming boat, he says. Maybe me swap, huh?
Everyone on the life raft, except for Vic, just smiles a brittle smile.
Where you going? Key West?
Bruce Lee examines Hero and Elliot for a while. Rotates his index finger to indicate that they should spin around and display their business ends. They do.
¿Cuánto?
Bruce Lee says. And all the pirates get uproarious, most of all Bruce Lee. Hero can feel his anal sphincter contracting to the size of a pore.
He's asking how much we cost, Elliot says. It's a joke, see? Because they know they can come over and have our asses for free.
Oh. Hilarious, Fisheye says.
While Hero and Elliot literally freeze their asses, he's still snuggled up under the canopy. That bastard.
Poon missile, like?
Bruce Lee says, pointing to one of the anti-ship missiles on the deck.
Bugs? Motorolas? Poon missile's a harpoon anti-ship missile, real expensive, Elliot says. A bug is a microchip. Motorola would be one brand, like Ford or Chevy. Bruce Lee deals in a lot of electronics, you know, typical Asian pirate dude.
He'd give us a harpoon missile for you guys, Fisheye says.
No, he's being sarcastic, shithead,
Elliot says.
Tell him we want a boat with an outboard motor, Fisheye says.
Want one Zoe, one kicker, fill her up, Elliot says.
Suddenly Bruce Lee gets real serious and actually considers it.
Scope claws, chum sand? Cajun gag. He'll consider if they can come and check out the merchandise first, Elliot says. They want to check out how tight we are and whether we are capable of suppressing our gag reflex. These are all terms from the raft brothel industry. Homeboys scope like 12 to me. Us homeboys look like we have 12-gauge assholes,
Elliot says,
i.e. that we are all stretched out and worthless.
Fisheye speaks up on his own.
No, 410s, totally.
The entire deck of the pirate ship titters with excitement.
No way, Bruce Lee says.
These hombres, Fisheye says, still got cherries up in there.
The whole deck erupts in rude screaming laughter. One of the pirates scrambles up to balance on the railing, gyrates one fist in the air, and hollers,
Bakanazu malaiga no malaria manopono ababsu.
By that point, all the other pirates have stopped laughing, gotten serious looks on their faces, and joined in, bellowing their own private streams of babble, rattling the air with a profound hoarse ululation. Hero's feet go out from under him as the raft moves suddenly. He can see Elliot falling down next to him.
He looks up at Bruce Lee's ship and flinches involuntarily as he sees what looks like a dark wave cresting over the rail, washing over the row of standing pirates, starting at the stern of the trawler and working its way forward. But this is just some kind of optical illusion. It is not really a wave at all. Suddenly, they are 50 feet away from the trawler, not 20 feet. As the laughter on the railing dies away, Hiro hears a new sound, a low whirring noise from the direction of Fisheye, and from the atmosphere around them, a tearing, hissing noise like the sound just before a thunderbolt strikes, like the sound of sheet being ripped in half. Looking back at Bruce Lee's trawler, he sees that the dark wave-like phenomenon was a wave of blood, as though someone hosed down the deck with a giant severed aorta. But it didn't come from outside. It erupted from the pirates' bodies, one at a time, moving from the stern to the bow. The deck of Bruce Lee's ship is now utterly quiet and motionless, except for blood and gelatinized internal organs sliding down the rusted steel and plopping softly into the water. Fisheye is up on his knees now and has torn away the canopy and space blanket that have covered him until this point. In one hand, he is holding a long device, a couple of inches in diameter, which is the source of the whirring noise. It is a circular bundle of parallel tubes, about pencil-sized and a couple of feet long, like a miniaturized Gatling gun. It whirs around so quickly that the individual tubes are difficult to make out. When it is operating, it is in fact ghostly and transparent because of this rapid movement, a glittering, translucent cloud jutting out of Fisheye's arm. The device is attached to a wrist-thick bundle of black tubes and cables that snake down into the large suitcase, which lies open on the bottom of the raft. The suitcase has a build-color monitor screen with graphics giving information of the status of this weapon system, how much ammo is left, the status of various subsystems. Hiro just gets a quick glimpse at it before all of the ammunition on board Bruce Lee's ship begins to explode.
"See, I told you they'd listen to reason," Fisheye says, shooting down the whirling gun.
Now Hiro sees a nameplate tacked into the control panel. Reason. Version 1.0B7. Gatling type, 3mm hypervelocity railgun system. Ing Security Industries, Inc. Pre-release version, not for field use. Do not test in a populated area. Ultima Ratio Regum.
"Fucking recoil pushed us halfway to China,"
Fisheye says appreciatively.
"Did you do that? What just happened?"
Elliot says.
"I did it. With reason.
See, it fires these teeny little metal splinters. They go real fast. More energy than a rifle bullet. Depleted uranium." The spinning barrels have now slowed almost to a stop. It looks like there are about 24 of them.
"I thought you hated machine guns," Hiro says. "I hate this fucking raft even more. Let's go get ourselves something that goes, you know? Something with a motor on it."
Because of the fires and small explosions going off on Bruce Lee's pirate ship, it takes them a minute to realize that several people are still alive there, still shooting at them. When Fisheye becomes aware of this, he pulls the trigger again. The barrels whir themselves up into a transparent cylinder, and the tearing, hissing noise begins again. As he waves the gun back and forth, hosing the target down with a hypersonic shower of depleted uranium, Bruce Lee's entire ship seems to sparkle and glitter, as though Tinkerbell was flying back and forth from stem to stern, sprinkling nuclear fairy dust over it. Bruce Lee's smaller yacht makes the mistake of coming around to see what's going on. Fisheye turns toward it for a moment, and its high protruding bridge slides off into the water. Major structural elements of the trawler are losing their integrity. Enormous popping and wrenching noises are coming from inside as big pieces of Swiss-cheesed metal give way, and the superstructure is slowly collapsing down into the hull like a botched souffle. When Fisheye notices this, he ceases fire.
"Cut it out, boss," Vic says.
"I'm melting," Fisheye crows.
We could have used that trawler, asshole,
Elliot says, vindictively yanking his pants back on.
I didn't mean to blow it all up. I guess the little bullets just go through everything.
Sharp thinking, Fisheye, Hero says.
Well, I'm sorry I took a little action to save our asses. Come on, let's go get one of them little boats before they all burn.
They paddle in the direction of the decapitated yacht. By the time they reach it, Bruce Lee's trawler is just a listing, empty steel hull with flames and smoke pouring out of it, spiced by the occasional explosion. The remaining portion of the yacht has many, many tiny little holes in it and glitters with exploded fragments of fiberglass. A million tiny little glass fibers about a millimeter long. The skipper and a crew member, or rather the stew that they turned into when the bridge was hit by reason, slid off into the water along with the rest of the debris, leaving behind no evidence of their having been there, except for a pair of long parallel streaks trailing off into the water. But there is a Filipino boy down in the galley so low, unhurt and only dimly aware of what happened. A number of electrical cables have been sawn in half. Elliot digs up a toolbox from below decks and spends the next 12 hours patching things together to the point where the engine can be started and the yacht can be steered. Hero, who has a rudimentary knowledge of electrical stuff, acts as gopher and limp-dicked advisor.
Did you hear the way the pirates were talking before Fisheye opened up on them?
Hero asks Elliot while they are working.
You mean in Pigeon?
No, at the very end. The babbling.
Yeah, that's a raft thing.
It is?
Yeah. One guy will start in, the rest will follow. I think it's just a fad.
But it's common on the raft.
Yeah. They all speak different languages, you know? All those different ethnic groups. It's like the fucking Tower of Babel. I think when they make that sound, when they babble at each other, they're just imitating what all the other groups sound like.
The Filipino kid starts making them some food. Vic and Fisheye sit down in the main cabin below decks, eating, going through Chinese magazines, looking at pictures of Asian chicks, and occasionally looking at nautical charts. When Elliot gets the electrical system back up and running, Hero plugs his personal computer in to recharge its batteries. By the time the yacht is up and running again, it's dark. To the southwest, a fluctuating column of light is playing back and forth against the low, overhanging cloud layer.
Is that the raft over there?
Fisheye says, pointing to the light as all hands converge on Elliot's makeshift control center.
It is, Elliot says.
They light it up at night so that the fishing boats can find their way back to it.
How far away do you think it is?
Fisheye says.
Elliot shrugs. 20 miles.
And how far to land?
I have no idea. Bruce Lee's skipper probably knew, but he's been pureed along with everyone else.
You're right, Fisheye says. I should have set it on whip or chop.
The raft usually stays at least 100 miles offshore, Hero says, to reduce the danger of snags.
How are we doing on gas?
I dipped the tank, Elliot says, and it looks like we're not doing so well, to tell you the truth.
What does that mean, not doing so well?
It's not always easy to read the level when you're out to sea, Elliot says. And I don't know how efficient these engines are. But if we're really 80 or 100 miles offshore, we might not make it.
So we go to the raft, Fisheye says. We go to the raft and persuade someone it's in his best interests to give us some fuel. Then back to the mainland.
No one really believes it's going to happen this way, least of all, Fisheye.
And, he continues, while we're there, on the raft, after we get the fuel and before we go home, some other stuff might happen too, you know. Life's unpredictable.
If you have something in mind, why don't you just spit it out, Hero says.
Okay, policy decision. The hostage tactic failed. So we go for an extraction.
Extraction of what?
Of YT.
I go along with that, Hero says. But I have another person I want to extract also, as long as we're extracting.
Who? Juanita, come on. You said yourself she was a nice girl.
If she's on the raft, maybe she's not so nice, Fisheye says.
I want to extract her anyway. We're all in this together, right? We're all part of Lagos's gang.
Bruce Lee has some people there, Elliot says.
Correction. Had.
But what I'm saying is, they're going to be pissed.
You think they're going to be pissed? I think they're going to be scared shitless, Fisheye says. Now drive the boat, Elliot. Come on. I'm sick of all this fucking water.
Raven ushers YT onto a flat-assed boat with a canopy on top. It is some kind of a riverboat that has been turned into a Vietnamese-American-Thai-Chinese business establishment. Kind of a bar-slash-restaurant-slash-whorehouse-slash-gambling-den. It has a few big rooms where lots of people are letting it all hang out, and a lot of little tiny steel-walled rooms down below where God knows what kind of activity is taking place. The main room is packed with low-life revelry. The smoke ties her bronchial passages into granny knots. The place is equipped with a shattering third-world sound system, pure distortion, echoing off painted steel walls at 300 decibels. A television set bolted onto one wall is showing foreign cartoons, done up in a two-color scheme of faded magenta and lime green, in which a ghoulish wolf, kind of like Wile E. Coyote with rabies, gets repeatedly executed in ways more violent than even Warner Brothers could think up. It's a snuff cartoon. The soundtrack is either turned off completely or else overwhelmed by the screeching melody coming out of the speakers. A bunch of erotic dancers are performing at one end of the room. It's impossibly crowded. They'll never get a place to sit. But shortly after Raven comes into the room, half a dozen guys in the corner suddenly stand bolt upright and scatter from a table, snatching up their cigarettes and drinks almost as an afterthought. Raven pushes YT through the room ahead of him like she's a figurehead on his kayak, and everywhere they go, people are shoved out of her way by Raven's almost palpable personal force field. Raven bends down and looks under the table, picks a chair up off the floor, and looks at the underside. You can never be too careful about those chair bombs. Sets it down, pushed all the way back into the corner where two steel walls meet, and sits down. He gestures for YT to do the same, and she does, her back to the action. From here, she can see Raven's face, illuminated mostly by occasional stabs of light, filtering through the crowd from the mirrored ball over the erotic dancers, and by the generalized green and magenta haze coming out of the TV set, spiked by the occasional flash when the cartoon wolf makes the mistake of swallowing another hydrogen bomb or has the misfortune to get hosed down again with a flamethrower. A waiter's there immediately. Raven commences hollering across the table at her. She can't hear him, but maybe he's asking her what she wants.
A cheeseburger, she screams back at him.
Raven laughs, shakes his head. You see any cows around here?
Anything but fish, she screams.
Raven talks to the waiter for a while in some variant of taxi lingo. I ordered you some squid, he hollers. That's a mollusk.
Great.
Raven, the last of the true gentlemen.
There is a shouted conversation lasting the better part of an hour. Raven does most of the shouting. YT just listens, smiles, and nods. Hopefully, he's not saying something like,
I enjoy really violent abusive sex acts.
She doesn't think he's talking about that at all. He's talking politics. She hears a fragmented history of the Aleuts, a burst here and a burst there, when Raven isn't poking squid into his mouth and the music isn't too loud.
Russians fucked us over. Smallpox had a 90% mortality rate. Worked as slaves in this sealing industry. Seward's folly. Fucking Nipponese took away my father in 42, put him in a POW camp for the duration. Then the Americans fucking nuked us. Can you believe that shit? Raven says.
There's a lull in the music. Suddenly she can hear complete sentences.
The Nipponese say they're the only people who were ever nuked. But every nuclear power has one aboriginal group whose territory they nuked to test their weapons. In America, they nuked the Aleutians. Amchitka. My father, Raven says, grinning proudly, was nuked twice. Once in Nagasaki, when he was blinded, and then again in 1972, when the Americans nuked our homeland.
Great, Whitey thinks. She's got a new boyfriend, and he's a mutant. Explains one or two things.
I was born a few months later,
Raven continues, by way of totally hammering that point home.
How did you get hooked up with these orthos?
I got away from our traditions and ended up living in Soldotna, working on oil rigs.
Raven says, like YT is supposed to just know where Soldotna is.
That was when I did my drinking and got this, he says, pointing to his tattoo. That's also when I learned how to make love to a woman, which is the only thing I do better than harpooning.
YT can't help but think that fucking and harpooning are closely related activities in Raven's mind. But as crude as the man is, she can't get around the fact that he's making her uncomfortably horny.
I used to work fishing boats, too, to make a little extra money. We would come back from a 48-hour halibut opening. This was way back in the old days when they had fishing regulations, and we'd put on our survival suits, stick beers into the pockets, and jump into the water and just float around drinking all night long. And one time, we were doing this, and I drank until I passed out. And when I woke up, it was the next day, or maybe a couple of days later, I don't know. And I was floating in my survival suit out in the middle of the Cook Inlet, all alone. The other guys on my fishing boat had forgotten about me.
Conveniently enough, Whitey thinks.
Anyway, I floated for a couple of days, got real thirsty, ended up washing ashore on Kodiak Island. By this time, I was real sick with the DTs and everything else. But I washed up near a Russian Orthodox church, and they found me, took me in, and straightened me out. And that was when I saw that the Western American lifestyle had come this close to killing me.
Here comes the sermon.
And I saw that we can only live through faith, living a simple lifestyle. No booze, no television, none of that stuff.
So, what are we doing in this place?
He shrugs.
This is an example of the bad places I used to hang out. But if you're going to get decent food on the raft, you have to come to a place like this.
A waiter approaches the table. His eyes are big, his movements tentative. He's not coming to take an order. He's coming to deliver bad news.
Sir, you are wanted on the radio. I'm sorry.
Who is it? Raven says.
The waiter just looks around him like he can't even speak the name in public.
It's very important, he says.
Raven heaves a big sigh, grabs one last piece of fish, and pokes it into his mouth. He stands up, and before YT can react, gives her a kiss on the cheek.
Honey, I got a job to do or something. Just wait right here for me, okay?
Here?
Nobody will fuck with you, Raven says.
As much for the benefit of the waiter as for YT. The raft looks uncannily cheerful from a few miles away. A dozen searchlights and at least that many lasers are mounted on the towering superstructure of the Enterprise, waving back and forth against the clouds like a Hollywood premiere. Closer up, it doesn't look so bright and crisp. The vast matted tangle of small boats radiates a murky cloud of yellow light that spoils the contrast. A couple of patches of the raft are burning. Not a nice cheery bonfire type of thing, but a high burbling flame with black smoke sliding out of it, like you get from a large quantity of gasoline.
Gang warfare, maybe, Elliot theorizes.
Energy source, Hero guesses.
Entertainment,
Fisheye says. They don't have cable on the fucking raft. Before they really plunge into hell, Elliot takes the lid off the fuel tank and slides dipstick into there, checking the fuel supply. He doesn't say anything, but he doesn't look especially happy.
Turn off all the lights, Elliot says, when it seems they're still miles away. Remember that we have already been sighted by several hundred or even several thousand people who are armed and hungry.
Vic is already going around the boat shutting off lights by the simple expedient of a ball-peen hammer. Fisheye just stands there and listens intently to Elliot, suddenly respectful. Elliot continues.
Take off all the bright orange clothing, even if it means we get cold. From now on, we lay down on the decks, expose ourselves as little as possible, and we don't talk to each other unless necessary. Vic, you stay midships with your rifle and wait for someone to hit us with a spotlight. Anyone hits us with a spotlight from any direction, you shoot it out. That includes flashlights from small boats. Hero, your job is gunnel patrol. You just keep going around the edges of this yacht, anywhere that a swimmer could climb up over the edge and slip on board, and when that happens, cut his arms off. Also, be on the lookout for any kind of grappling hook type stuff. Fisheye, if any other floating object comes within 100 feet of us, sink it. If you see raft people with antennas coming out of their heads, try to kill them first, because they can talk to each other.
Antennas coming out of their heads, Hero says.
Yeah, raft gargoyle types,
Elliot says. Who are they?
How the fuck should I know? I've just seen them a few times from a distance. Anyway, I'm going to take us straight in toward the center, and once we get close enough, I'll turn to starboard and swing around the raft counterclockwise, looking for someone who might be willing to sell us fuel. If worst comes to worst, and we end up on the raft itself, we stick together, and we hire ourselves a guide, because if we try to move across the raft without the help of someone who knows the web, we'll get into a bad situation.
Like what kind of bad situation? Fisheye asks.
Like hanging out on a rotted-out, slime-covered cargo net between two ships, rocking different ways with nothing underneath us except ice water full of plague rats, toxic waste, and killer whales. Any questions?
Yeah, Fisheye says. Can I go home now? Good. If Fisheye is scared, so is Hero.
Remember what happened to the pirate named Bruce Lee, Elliot says. He was well-armed and powerful. He pulled up alongside a life raft full of refuse one day, looking for some poontang, and he was dead before he knew it. Now, there are a lot of people who want to do that to us.
Don't they have some kind of cops or something?
Vic says.
I heard they did.
In other words, Vic has killed a lot of time going to raft movies in Times Square.
The people up on the Enterprise operate in kind of a Wrath of God mode, Elliot says. They have big guns mounted around the edge of the flight deck. Big Gatling guns, like Reason, except with larger bullets. They were originally put there to shoot down Exocet missiles. They stack with the force of a meteorite. If people act up out on the raft, they will make the problem go away. But a little murder or riot isn't enough to get their attention. If it's a rocket duel between rival pirate organizations, that's different.
Suddenly, they've been nailed with a spotlight, so big and powerful they can't look anywhere near it. Then it's dark again, and a gunshot from Vic's rifle is searing and reverberating across the water.
Nice shooting, Vic, Fisheye says.
It's like one of them drug dealer boats,
Vic says, looking through his magic sight.
5 guys on it, headed our way.
He fires another round.
Correction, 4 guys on it.
Boom.
Correction. They're not headed our way anymore.
Boom. A fireball erupts from the ocean 200 feet away.
Correction. No boat.
Fisheye laughs and actually slaps his thigh.
You recording all of this, Hero?
No, Hero says. Wouldn't come out.
Oh.
Fisheye seems taken aback, like this changes everything.
That's the first wave, Elliot says. Rich pirates looking for easy pickings. But they've got a lot to lose, so they scare easy.
Another big yacht-type boat is out there,
Vic says.
But they're turning away now.
Above the deep chortling noise of their yacht's big diesel, they can hear the high whine of outboard motors.
Second wave, Elliot says. Pirate wannabes. These guys will come in a lot faster, so stay sharp.
This thing has millimeter wave on it, Fisheye says.
Hero looks at him. His face is illuminated from below by the glow of Reason's built-in screen.
I can see these guys like it's fucking daylight.
Vic fires several rounds, pops the clip out of his rifle, shoves in a new one. A Zodiac zips past, skittering across the wave tops, strafing them with weak flashlight beams. Fisheye fires a couple of short bursts from Reason, blasting clouds of warm steam into the cold night air, but misses them.
Save your ammo, Elliot says. Even with Uzis, they can't hit us until they slow down a bit. And even with radar, you can't hit them.
A second Zodiac whips past them on the other side, closer than the last one. Vic and Fisheye both hold their fire. They hear it orbiting them, swinging back around the way it came.
Those two boats are getting together out there, Vic says. They got two more of them, a total of four. They're talking.
We've been reconned, Elliot says, and they're planning their tactics. The next time is for real.
A second later, two fantastically loud blasts sound from the rear of the yacht where Elliot is, accompanied by brief flashes of light. Hero turns around to see a body collapsing to the deck. It's not Elliot. Elliot is crouching there holding his oversized halibut shooter. Hero runs back, looks at the dead swimmer in the dim light scattering off the clouds. He's naked except for a thick coating of black grease and a belt with a gun and a knife in it. He's still holding onto the rope that he used to pull himself on board. The rope is attached to a grappling hook that is caught in the jagged, broken fiberglass on one side of the yacht.
Third wave is coming a little early.
He's high and shaky. He's trying so hard to sound cool that it has the opposite effect.
Hero, this gun's got three rounds left in it, and I'm saving the last one for you if any more of these motherfuckers get on board.
Sorry. Hero says.
He draws the short wakizashi. He would feel better if he can carry his nine in the other hand, but he needs one hand free to steady himself and keep from falling overboard. He makes a quick circuit of the yacht, looking for more grappling hooks, and actually finds one on the other side hooked into one of the railing stanchions, a taut rope trailing out behind it into the sea. Correction. It's a taut cable. His sword won't cut it. And the tension on the rope is such that he can't get it unhooked from the stanchion. As he's squatting there playing with the grappling hook, a greasy hand rises up out of the water and grabs his wrist. Another hand gropes for Hero's other hand and grabs the sword instead. Hero yanks the weapon free, feeling it do damage, and shoves the wakizashi point first into the place between those two hands, just as someone is sinking his teeth into Hero's crotch. But Hero's crotch is protected. The motorcycle outfit has a hard plastic cup. And so this human shark just gets a mouthful of bulletproof fabric. Then his grip loosens and he falls into the sea. Hero releases the grappling hook and drops it in with him. Vic fires three rounds in quick succession, and a fireball illuminates one whole side of the ship. For a moment, they can see everything around them for a distance of 100 yards, and the effect is like turning on your kitchen lights in the middle of the night and finding your countertops aswarm with rats. At least a dozen small boats are around them.
They got Molotov cocktails, Vic says.
The people in the boats can see them, too. Tracers fly around them from several directions. Hero can see muzzle flashes in at least three places. Fisheye opens up once, twice with Reason, just firing short bursts of a few dozen rounds each, and produces one fireball, this one farther away from the yacht. It's been at least 5 seconds since Hero moved, so he checks this area for grappling hooks again and resumes his circuit around the edge of the yacht. This time it's clear. The two grease balls must have been working together. A Molotov cocktail arcs through the sky and impacts on the starboard side of the yacht, where it's not going to do much damage. Inside would be a lot worse.
Fisheye uses reason to hose down the area from which the Molotov was thrown. But now that the side of the boat is all lit up from the flames, they draw more small arms fire. In that light, Hiro can see trickles of blood running down from the area where Vic ensconced himself. On the port side, he sees something long and narrow and low in the water, with the torso of a man rising out of it. The man has long hair that falls down around his shoulders, and he's holding an 8-foot pole in one hand. Just as Hiro sees him, he's throwing it. The harpoon darts across 20 feet of open water. The million-chipped facets of its glass head refract the light and make it look like a meteor. It takes Fisheye in the back, slices easily through the bulletproof fabric he's wearing under his suit, and comes all the way out the other side of his body. The impact lifts Fisheye into the air and throws him off the boat. He lands face first in the water, already dead. Mental note: Raven's weapons do not show up on radar. Hiro looks back in the direction of Raven, but he's already gone. A couple more greaseballs, side by side, vault over the railing about 10 feet forward of Hiro, but for a moment, they're dazzled by the flames. Hiro pulls out his 9, aims it their way, and keeps pulling the trigger until both of them have fallen back into the water. He's not sure how many rounds are left in the gun now. There's a coughing, hissing noise, and the flame light gets dim and finally goes out. Elliot nailed it with a fire extinguisher. The yacht jerks out from under Hero's feet, and he hits the deck with his face and shoulder. Getting up, he realizes that either they've just rammed or been rammed by something big. There is a thudding noise, feet running on the deck. Hiro hears some of these feet near him, drops his wakizashi, pulls his katana, whirls at the same time, snapping the long blade into someone's midsection. Meanwhile, they're dragging a long knife down his back, but it doesn't penetrate the fabric, just hurts a little. His katana comes free easily, which is dumb luck, because he forgot to squeeze off the blow, could have gotten it wedged in there. He turns again, instinctively parries a knife thrust from another greaseball, raises the katana and snaps it down into his brain pan. This time, he does it right, kills him without sticking the blade. There are greaseballs on two sides of him now. Hiro chooses a direction, swings it sideways, decapitates one of them. Then he turns around. Another greaseball is staggering toward him across the pitching deck with a spiked club. But unlike Hiro, he's not keeping his balance. Hiro shuffles up to meet him, keeping his center of gravity over his feet, and impales him on the katana. Another greaseball is watching all of this in astonishment from up near the bow. Hiro shoots him, and he collapses to the deck. Two more greaseballs jump off the boat voluntarily. The yacht is tangled up in a spider's web of shitty old ropes and cargo nets that were stretched out across the surface of the water as a snare for poor suckers like them. The yacht's engine is still straining, but the prop isn't moving. Something got wrapped around the shaft. There's no sign of Raven now. Maybe it was just a one-time contract hit on Fisheye. Maybe he didn't want to get tangled up in the spider web. Maybe he figured that once Reason was taken out, the greaseballs would take care of the rest. Elliot's no longer at the controls. He's no longer even on the yacht. Hiro calls out his name, but there's no response. Not even thrashing in the water. The last thing he did was lean over the edge with a fire extinguisher, putting out the Molotov flame. When they were jerked to a halt, he must have tumbled overboard. They're a lot closer to the Enterprise than he had ever thought. They covered a lot of water during the fight, got closer in than they should have. In fact, Hiro surrounded on all sides by the raft at this point. Meager, flickering illumination is provided by the burning remains of the Molotov cocktail-carrying Zodiacs, which have become tangled in the net around them. Hiro does not think it would be wise to take the yacht back out toward open water. It's a little too competitive there. He goes up forward. The suitcase that served Reason's power supply and ammo dump is open on the deck next to him, its color monitor screen reading, "Sorry, a fatal system error occurred. Please reboot and try again." Then, as Hero's looking at it, it fritzes out completely and dies of a snow crash. Vic got hit by one of the machine gun bursts and is also dead.
Around them, half a dozen other boats ride on the waves, caught in the spider web, nice-looking yachts, all of them. But they are all empty hulks, stripped of their engines and everything else, just like duck decoys in front of a hunter's blind. A hand-painted sign rides on a buoy nearby, reading fuel in English and other languages. Farther out to sea, a number of the ships that were chasing them earlier are lingering, steering well clear of the spider web. They know they can't come in here. This is the exclusive domain of the black grease swimmers, the spiders in the web, almost all of whom are now dead. If he goes onto the raft itself, it can't be any worse, can it? The yacht has its own little dinghy, the smallest size of inflatable Zodiac, with a small outboard motor. Hiro gets it into the water.
"I go with you,"
a voice says. Hiro whirls, hauling out his gun, and finds himself aiming it into the face of the Filipino cabin boy. The boy blinks, looks a little surprised, but not especially scared. He has been hanging out with pirates, after all. For that matter, all the dead guys on the yacht don't seem to faze him either.
"I be your guide,"
the boy says.
"Balazinka nuparata."
YT waits so long that she thinks the sun must have come up by now, but she knows it can't really be more than a couple of hours. In a way, it doesn't even matter. Nothing ever changes. The music plays, the cartoon videotape rewinds itself and starts up again, men come in and drink, and try not to get caught staring at her. She might as well be shackled to the table anyway. There's no way she could ever find her way back home from here. So she waits. Suddenly, Raven's standing in front of her. He's wearing different clothes, wet, slippery clothing made out of animal skins or something. His face is red and wet from being outside.
"You get your job all done?"
"Sort of," Raven says. "I did enough."
"What do you mean, enough?"
"I mean, I don't like being called out of a date to do bullshit work," Raven says. "So I got things in order out there. And my attitude is, let his gnomes worry about the details."
"Well, I've been having a great time here."
"Sorry, baby. Let's get out of here," he says, speaking with the intense, strained tones of a man with an erection. "Let's go to the core," he says, once they get into the cool air above deck.
"What's there?"
"Everything," he says. "The people who run this whole place. Most of these people," he waves his hand out over the raft, "can't go there. I can. Want to see it?"
"Sure. Why not?" she says, hating herself for sounding like such a sap. But what else is she going to say?
He starts leading her down a long moonlit series of gangplanks, in toward the big ships in the middle of the raft. "You can almost skate here, but you'd have to be really good."
"Why are you so different from the other people?" YT says.
She kind of blurts it out without doing a whole lot of thinking first. But it seems like a good question. He laughs.
"I'm an Aleut. I'm different in a lot of way."
"No. I mean, your brain works in a different way," YT says. "You're not whacked out. You know what I mean? You haven't mentioned the word all night."
"We have a thing we do in kayaks. It's like surfing," Raven says.
"Really? I've surfed too. In traffic," YT says.
"We don't do this for fun," Raven says. "It's part of how we live. We get from island to island by surfing on waves."
"Same here," YT says. "Except we go from one franchlet to the next by surfing on cars."
"See, the world is full of things more powerful than us. But if you know how to catch a ride, you can go places," Raven says.
"Right. I'm totally hip to what you're saying."
"That's what I'm doing with the Orthos. I agree with some of their religion, but not all of it. But their movement has a lot of power. They have a lot of people and money and ships.
and you're surfing on it.
Yeah.
That's cool. I can relate. What are you trying to do? I mean, what's your real goal?
They're crossing a big, broad platform. Suddenly, he's right behind her. His arms are around her body, and he draws her back into him. Her